Hello, Next Picture Show listeners. Here's a friendly reminder that if you enjoy the Next Picture Show, you'll really enjoy getting more Next Picture Show by subscribing to our Patreon. You can unlock ad-free versions of the podcast for $3 a month and get bonus episodes on current TV, movies we don't cover in the podcast, and other topics for $5 a month. We currently have a bonus episode about the new miniseries Shogun, adapted from James Clavell's novel, and we have more coming up soon. To subscribe to our Patreon, please visit patreon.com/nextpictureshow. That's patreon.com/nextpictureshow.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome to the Next Picture Show, a movie of the week podcast devoted to a classic film and how it shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Keith Phipps, here with
Tasha Robinson
and Scott Tobias.
Genevieve, alas, is attempting to outrun a horde of creatures that insists on being called infected, not zombies. So we'll have to get by without her this week.
Okay, wait. Are they slow infected or are they fast infected? Because that's going to make a big difference.
You can't be, the purist will not allow you to be fast. You can be fast infected, but you can't be fast zombies. That's a big no-no that I'm sure it will come up in the conversation here.
We'll get into the whole zombie, not zombie issue in depth. But in the meantime, Tasha, can you tell us what the films we'll be discussing over the next two episodes?
The new film Civil War depicts an America of the seemingly very near future that's been torn apart by a conflict between a dictatorial president, currently in his third term in office, and breakaway factions, including an alliance between Texas and California. It's the latest film from Alex Garland, the fourth directorial effort from the novelist-turned-filmmaker. Starring Kirsten Dunst as a photojournalist attempting to make her way to Washington, D.C., its journey through a country transformed by a violent catastrophe put us in mind of Garland's first film as a screenwriter, 28 Days Later, a zombie-adjacent horror film directed by Danny Boyle.
So with this episode, we'll return to the apocalyptic England of 2002, where a handful of survivors live in fear of a fast-moving, virus-afflicted threat. Then we'll tour in America with no literal monsters, but plenty of threats to call its own.
You never go anywhere alone unless you've got no choice.
Hello?
Lesson two, only travel during daylight unless you've got no choice.
This really is a bad idea. You know why? It's obviously a bad idea.
We have to leave now. More will be coming. They always do.
Let's start with the ending and what it means that Danny Boyle and Alex Garland knew how they wanted to begin 28 Days Later, but not how it would conclude. In the version of 28 Days Later released to theaters, our three surviving protagonists escape the stately home-turned-military compound, though one, Jim, played by Cillian Murphy, has been badly injured. Nonetheless, he survives, the infected begin to die off, and, as the film ends, Jim and his companion Selena, Naomi Harris, and the 14-year-old Hannah, Megan Burns, have caught the attention of a plane passing over the country house they've claimed as their own. But Boyle and Garland shot two other endings and considered a third. In one that never made it past storyboards, the fourth member of their party, Frank, a cab driver played by Brendan Gleeson, is taken to an underground lab and treated after being infected rather than killed. Another recreates the theatrical ending, but with only Selena and Hannah having survived. And in a third, Jim dies in a hospital, his journey coming full circle, and Selena and Hannah walk away to face an uncertain future. This was Boyle and Garland's original ending, and tacked on to some prints a few weeks into the film's release, preceded by a title reading, What If? That's a lot of possibilities, but maybe it's fitting that a movie so effective at conveying the way things fall apart wouldn't know how to put it all back together in the end. Inspired by apocalyptic horror stories from Day of the Triffids through George Romero's Dead trilogy, 28 Days Later opens after the action depicted in similar films has settled down. Comatose and abandoned, Jim, a former bike messenger, awakens in a London hospital to a city of empty streets, yellowing newspapers, and strewn about souvenirs. He soon learns why, after encountering the first of many of those infected with the Rage virus, a lab-borne disease that turns humans into murderous berserkers. What happens next takes Jim on a journey through the stages of grief, though perhaps not in the expected order, as he finds himself unable to believe what's going on, mourns his parents after finding them dead in their home, and experiences the joy of shopping without the obligation of paying for anything. Perhaps Jim, Selena, Frank, and Hannah's journey through the English countryside can be seen as one long act of acceptance, as they observe an Earth that's no longer reshaped by the needs of humanity. But humanity has a way of persisting. The four prove canny at surviving, at least up to a point, and they find a pocket of soldiers who have attempted to carve order out of chaos and perhaps begin to rebuild civilization, even if that means luring unsuspecting women to their compound. And maybe that's why 28 Days Later has such a hard time drawing its story to a close. Everything leading up to the final scene has expressed a distrust in the idea of order and civilization. It's fragile enough to crumble within weeks of the arrival of a plague. Its rawest form seems to require the strong to subjugate the weak and laughs at the idea of freedom. It's hard to carve a happy ending out of this raw material. But it's hard, too, to feel like a nihilistic ending is the only possibility. There's been too much hope. The trust forged between strangers, the family of horses carrying on oblivious to the problems elsewhere, the continued existence of single malt scotch. For a film like 28 Days Later to end only in darkness. So maybe the seemingly silly decision to add a second ending was the right choice after all. A final what-if that it lets viewers wind down a story that opens with one of the scariest what-ifs of its era in the way that they choose.
Dad, are you all right?
Yeah, I'm fine, sweetheart. Sorry I lost my temper. Hannah, I love you very much.
What?
Keep away from me. Stay where you are.
Dad?
Keep away from me!
Dad?
Keep away from me!
All right, everyone. So let's go back and talk about the ending as I did at the beginning of the above. You know, I offered a theory as to why there are, you know, this movie was proved so difficult to end. What are your thoughts on the ending of this film and why there are so many of them?
You're doing this Memento style. We're going to start at the end of the movie.
We are. We're going to Benjamin Button our way back to the beginning of the movie.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of feel like cut off from the rest of it because you're in this different location and there's a sense of safety and even kind of bliss that's happening before you get, you know, this suggestion of hope that they're going to get rescued. I mean, and, you know, I confess to feeling quite a bit of relief with that ending. I mean, I think you could certainly take this premise to a bleak place in terms of how far this infection has spread or what might have happened with Jim. But I don't mind. I don't mind there being a kind of reward for all of the stuff that these characters have been through. We're invested in them. They've been through a lot. They've seen people very close to them turn and die, and they've been under a great deal of stress and threat. And it's you know, I feel okay with that bit of relief at the end. So I can certainly see, you know, how there's kind of a choose your own adventure quality to the way that this film wraps up.
Yeah, I haven't read anything about Garland or Danny Boyle talking about what they intended for kind of the themes of this movie. And given how strong the themes seem to be in this version of it, in the theatrically released version of it, and given that they had a version of it that didn't have the soldiers at all, I wonder if they came into this, you know, thinking of images or thinking of tone or thinking of particular action scenes, but not really thinking of it as having a theme or a through line. Because I don't know what this movie is without the third act with the soldiers. From what I've read of the Brendan Gleeson positive ending, when they go to that lab, they've taken Brendan Gleeson alive and they take him there and they find out that there is a cure for rage, but it involves a complete blood transfusion.
Right.
So Jim sacrifices his life to give all of his blood to Brendan Gleeson and is infected in turn by taking on all of Brendan Gleeson's blood, which, you know, from what I've read, Boyle and Garland had a very hard time justifying, like, why would Jim do this, though? And there was kind of the neat parallelism of him starting in a hospital bed and, like, ending in a hospital bed. But other than that, it didn't have a narrative through line. So, you know, to me, all of these different endings feel like maybe filmmakers starting, you know, there's kind of famously people who write stories without having an ending in mind and just see where it goes. Neil Gaiman is one of those. And then there are people that start with the ending or, you know, start with the big themes and flesh things out. So, you know, to me, this just sounds like, okay, this was their process. We just happen to know more about it than we do in most creative cases. But at the same time, one second.
What's going on there?
Intrusive cat that I don't need sitting on the recorder. But at the same time, I find myself thinking, You know how much Scott resists analyzing a movie with through like extra textuals or like letting extra textuals influence him? I feel like my equivalent of that is I never want to know that a creative person didn't know what they were doing when they made something. I never want to be told that. It takes me out of a story to have a director say, you know, yeah, I was fumbling around here, or I didn't know what I wanted to do, or I have no idea why it's like that. Like, I want to pretend that storytellers are decisive and know where they want to go. And I don't know if I like any of these proposed endings better, per se. You know, I'm with Scott. I like the happy ending. I feel relieved by the happy ending, mm-hmm. especially since so many zombie movies that followed this have just ruthlessly grim everybody dies endings. So, like, I'm fine with the ending. I don't know whether it's the best ending of the many proposed, and I don't necessarily want to be in a position to try to judge that. I don't know. Keith, do any of these endings stand out for you as one that you'd rather see?
I was never bothered by the theatrical ending. I mean, it may be a stretch that Jim would survive that, given that Selena is a chemist, but not a doctor, and he did get shot. But, you know, I'll buy it. It's a movie. I think there's kind of poetry to those images of the infected dying by the side of the road. It's, you know, just like this too has run its course in a way, like nature's kind of correcting itself in a way. And I think there's those images of those dying infected in the country road. It's one of my favorite images in the film.
There's also just sort of a thematic resonance there in the idea that this isn't a biological weapon, as far as we know. This is, the scientist at the beginning just says, it's rage. Like, we're trying to understand this so we can cure it. There is something, I think, you know, thematic and resonant in the idea that even phenomenal, like, world-damaging anger dies out eventually. Like no anger can last forever.
That's kind of one element, if I'm going to stick up for the devil in this story, the one not terrible rationale that West has for keeping a zombie around or keeping an infected person around to see how long it will take to starve is that's not bad. That's not a bad rationale, honestly. You know, I mean, if you're talking about the survival of the race, I mean, he's got some bad ideas about how to do that, how the humans might survive. But that one idea of just like, if they can no longer eat, how long are they going to last? That's not bad. So kudos to my guy, West.
they don't have to taunt the infected guy that much, though. They're pretty.
No, they
pretty
do. They do. No, they're not great.
To somebody who might have been their friend, you know, at least someone they worked with.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's listed in the credits as Private Mailer, which, you know, suggests that he might have been one of their squad at one point.
Oh, sure. No, he was.
The tormenting the infected thing kind of has an air of hubris. You know, there's an element of kind of whistling past the graveyard there, of trying to make a fear that's so huge you don't have any, there's nothing you can do with it, small enough to manage, you know, by belittling it and mocking it. But, you know, they also like literally invite their own death into their own home, which is just very Shakespearean.
It's true. We should probably pull back and talk about the way this film looks, which is very much state-of-the-art digital
state
video
of the
2002.
Uh-huh.
State of the art, like, you know, consumer grade digital
480,
video.
480, what is it?
Yeah.
480 resolution, maybe.
Yeah, it's working with a limited budget, and I'm sure using the DV equipment was, you know, helped feed into that budget. It's not a great looking movie.
No.
But is that cruddiness kind of purposeful? I think you can argue that it is, that kind of suits the material. And also, like, every once in a while, I mean, not even every once in a while, quite frequently, there are compositions and gestures and you know, the way sequences are strung together remind you there's a real filmmaker behind this cruddy camera. I mean, Danny Boyle knows what he's doing, and I think in some ways, to me at least, he exploits some of the limitations in ways that are interesting, although it is hard on the eyes.
Yeah. I mean, Anthony Dodd-Mantle shot it. And at that point in time, he was kind of on the cutting edge of digital cinematography. I mean, to me, all this stuff, this entire era, this entire like way of shooting, the Dogma 95 was happening at this time too. You know, this early 2000s, these early 2000s DV movies, I mean, they're just so, it's like carbon dating. It's like, okay, I know when this was made and what they were trying to do.
While this infection was going on, Igby was going down somewhere.
Exactly. Igby was going down. Yeah, that would have been right around the same time, right? Like all these Indigent Productions was the name of the production company that put that out and put the thing out with Katie Holmes on Thanksgiving. What was that thing called?
I forget.
Yeah. Katie Holmes on Thanksgiving, those types of films, and Lars von Trier is doing films like The Idiots, and anyway, I kind of, you know, but of course you can tell there's a real filmmaker here. I mean, the film is done with great style at times. You know, the opening sequence when he's out of the hospital and sort of wandering around London is just extremely exciting, but though I think the music plays a big part in that, you know, and I think you can get, I mean, obviously there's a texture they were going for here, a rough-hewn quality, a deliberate lack of slickness that, you know, I understand the sort of aesthetic rationale, but at the same time, you can pull it off a 16mm, and there's just no way the budget was so low that you could not have made a film that has a certain amount of urgency but does not rely on these god-awful cameras. So for me, it's still kind of a negative, but I'm also much more closed-minded when it comes to this kind of thing. I mean, to me at the time, you know, when Soderbergh did his did that movie that everyone hated. What was that called?
Bubble.
Full Frontal.
Or
Full Frontal. Exactly.
I like Full Frontal though.
So like I do too. I like it pretty well. And he did, of course, Bubble, which actually is a quite good looking DV film. But Full Frontal was him saying, okay, this is a limited piece of technology. Let's actually lean into that a little bit. And I think that's kind of what Boyle does here. It's like we're not even going to try to use this camera to make something movie like. We're going to kind of play up its limitations. And I think that's kind of a smart approach, even if I don't necessarily, love it.
I don't know. I remember when this movie came out, just watching it in theaters and thinking, oh my gosh, this is so innovative. This is so stylish. This is so stylized. You know, this is so cutting edge. And now I look at this movie and I just find it very, very hard to understand why I thought that. You know, this movie has just been so thoroughly eclipsed by the movies that iterated on it, both in terms of how digital cameras and digital shooting has developed and in terms of zombie narratives. You know, it's very, very, very far from the first zombie movie. But it did kind of define a lot of things that, you know, went on to take over zombie stories and a lot more sophisticated stories. You know, this one walked so that they could, I don't know, shamble along very, very quickly and jerkily towards somebody's throat, I guess, to overextend the metaphor. But like watching it now, it seems so simple visually and it seems so simple narratively, except for a few things that it's doing that I don't particularly care for. I still really like the performances. Mm-hmm. And as you say, there are compositions in there where there's one moment where they're starting out on their journey and there's just this incredibly wide road, a completely like untouched highway ahead of them, kind of like arching off into the horizon, and they just sit there for a moment. And I find myself thinking, boy, I wish a real camera had captured this. I wish there were like decent images of this, you know, because if they'd shot it on film, it could have been cleaned up. We could have seen what that looked like in, you know, real color and real light. And I'm a little sad that can't happen.
AI will fix it for you someday, Tasha. AI, make 28 Days Later pretty. We'll see what
that
looks
better
like.
Better that than telling it write a new zombie movie.
Yeah.
I had not seen this film since it came out, and I think I was a little bit on the lower end of it than other critics at the time. And I did like it a little more this time. I think it really impressed me. I mean, some of the style of it is very exciting. The performances are really good. I think it's really strong on a script level in a way I don't think I appreciated at the time. Maybe I was watching it and was so hung up on the kind of the conceit and the look of it, that sort of thing, that I didn't really appreciate the amount of work that was going on into this thing on kind of a conceptual level, on a character level, you know, on a thematic level. I think it's a really nice script. So kudos to Alex Garland. I think as Garland's career has sort of evolved and he's gone into making his own movies, you can see the seeds of this movie sort of planted and kind of growing into a different, all these other sorts of visions that reveals, you know, certain thematic obsessions that he was really onto and really thinking through pretty clearly right here from the start as a screenwriter. So I, you know, obviously he was a novelist prior to that, but I definitely appreciated the screenplay of this film more than I did 22 years ago.
Yeah, seeing what he eventually did land on in terms of this little group of soldiers, how they behave, how they treat the female characters in particular, how they kind of, you know, bolster each other's worst behavior, really throws Alex Garland's men into a new light for me. You know, revisiting this movie reminded me a lot of some things that go on thematically in that movie. And, you know, even in movies like The Beach, also derived from a Garland novel and a Garland screenplay, that just sense of, you know, individual people can be decent and ethical and human, groups of people maybe not so much.
Yeah,
it just seems like something that stretches throughout his work, just a strain of cynicism and weariness that also, you know, is a weary cynic I find very true to life, maybe defeatist but still kind of insightful.
Yeah, he's been doing these sort of Lord of the Flies situations over and over again, where you have this some kind of a event that just causes civilization to unravel, and then people kind of have to. It tends to make people behave mostly in very very bad ways, particularly as you say in groups where they kind of egg each other on, which is gave me a lot of appreciation for what ultimately they went with in this third act. I would have been, you know, hearing of this theoretical third act that did something completely different. Is kind of a bummer to consider, because I feel like it's a strong, for one, it's the third act I like, but then also getting there is one of the most exciting and heartbreaking sort of gear shifts in the film. I mean, Brendan Gleeson's fate is just so heartbreaking.
Well, you know, he's spurred on by like trying to like protect the dignity of this corpse, and it's just it's a poetic moment for that character, but it's, you know, has consequences.
Absolutely.
But also, you know, again, thematically, he gives into rage. It's a little moment of anger where he strikes out at something that, you know, that can't be controlled. Like you can't stop carrion crows from eating carrion. And the fact that he chases it off and like strikes out at the shed that it's sitting on, and that's why it all happens. It just seems to me that there's pastoral quiet in this movie, and it's when people are treating each other like equals and listening to each other and appreciating each other and just like sitting together content with what they have. And then there's, you know, a very Buddhist desire leads to despair. Desire leads to pain, stretches throughout this film. You know, whenever anybody acts out in anger or in lust, they're punished and destroyed for it. And that's what I see that death coming out of. But yeah, it's a terrible dark irony. And I still remember the emotional impact of seeing that on screen the first time.
Yeah.
Pretty painful.
Well, and just like, I think it's also a moment where the speed at which people turn pays off so well. I mean, because this drop of blood hits him in the eye, and he has 10 seconds to do where he has to do a lot of different things, where he has to tell his daughter that he loves her and then also absolutely keep her away from him and do so in the sharpest, scariest, most upsetting way possible in order to protect her. And that again is the conceit of the film, you know, paying kind of huge emotional dividends.
Looping back to Garland's big themes, it's not just groups are bad, or, you know, people egg each other on in the worst ways, or people justify each other's worst intentions. It's also just very often built around gender. You know, if you look at men, if you look at Ex Machina in particular, there's less of it in Civil War. And in The Beach, it feels like, you know, the fact that it's a man and a woman conflicting is not quite arbitrary, but, you know, less pointed about society and more pointed about the individual people involved. But, you know, it honestly makes Annihilation look even more interesting to me in retrospect, in terms of it being a primarily female cast and being a story that, you know, that one is derived from a Jeff Vandermeer novel, but it's very heavily altered from what the novel is. It very much Garland's own exploration of the ideas. And the fact that he, you know, goes into places where it's about women interacting with each other, mostly like outside the auspices of men, even if the film is sort of framed with the protagonist's relationship with a man, I think makes it just really interesting in his work, considering how often he comes back to the ideas that we see here, that, you know, men and women can live in concert up to a point. And at the point where men stop treating women like people, it just completely falls apart for the women specifically. The gender stuff here is ugly and, you know, very, very intentional.
It really is. And like, I actually found the complaint about this movie when it came out was the third act didn't work. And I never thought that. I like all three acts. I did find the third act a little wearisome, but I think now that you mention it, maybe because it feels like Garland kind of does this a little better later. Not to sidetrack, but Tasha, did you like Men?
No.
I was the one person who seemed to like that movie, but I thought it was really interesting and well done.
Man, I mean, that's a whole side conversation. I would love to dig into what you liked about Men. I thought that movie was shot in just such a beautiful and striking way. Mm-hmm. I thought it was really, you know, an effective horror movie in a lot of ways. And then the combination of that last act, not even the last act, the last big sequence, and Garland just like so aggressively like not wanting to talk about what it was or where it came from, about like really just wanting to sort of leave all of these things out there for people to talk about, I found it pretty unsatisfying. In terms of the third act not working here, what doesn't work about it for me is, I mean, it's a classic Trinity Syndrome case. When Selena first shows up, she's this terrifying badass. She saves the male protagonist's life. She ruthlessly cuts down a companion of hers, like the second that he gets sick. She makes it clear that she is not going to be attached to anyone or anything, you know, that'll endanger her life, that she's going to survive no matter what. And then the third act is that helpless doofus rescuing her, you know, while she runs back and forth screaming. And I found that very frustrating. You know, she stops being an equal protagonist. She stops being an equal role in this movie. And, you know, seeing it again all of these years later, one of the things that strikes me most about it is, like, I respect it maybe a little less for all of the movies and other kinds of stories that iterated on it and did more thorough things with it. But boy, it makes me uncomfortable about Robert Kirkman's The Walking Dead, which takes the entire opening act kind of full cloth and then kind of resurrects Selena as Michonne, you know, once again, this like incredibly badass black woman who carries around a huge bladed weapon and cuts down anyone who gets in her way and is the toughest person on the planet and then slowly starts revealing a softer side. I did go and look up Kirkman's interviews, and he steadfastly claims that he had not seen or, you know, read any hints of 28 Days Later when he wrote the beginning of The Walking Dead. Mm-hmm. But the similarities are really striking. And watching Naomi Harris run around with her machete, I was like, am I just seeing something that Robert Kirkman on some level saw and thought, let's give her a better and more dignified life than Selena gets.
Well, that's a whole other podcast. Yeah. Not Walking Dead's a whole other thing. But yeah, interesting.
I mean, I get the complaints, I suppose, with the third act, but I like that the film went there. You know, it just gives it a completely new angle to consider this whole crisis from. You know, the hope is that they're going to end up in this little patch of humanity where they're going to be with other people and they're going to figure out a way to be safe and for society to move forward. And then you see what the flaws, to put it mildly, of these guys trying to remake society the way they try to do it, which is horrifying, but also plausible to me. And I think a big part of that, I think, is Christopher Eccleston's performance is really strong and scary and persuasive. I mean, I think you get a good idea of the kind of culture that he is able to build around himself, you know, and the sorts of soldiers that he molds in his image to behave the way that they do to kind of operate as one. So I like that piece of it for sure. It's not perfectly executed, but I think I would miss it if it were not there.
There is nothing scarier than a villain who truly believes that he is doing the ethical thing by setting aside like an entire segment of humanity as property, basically. Mm-hmm. You know, whether it's whatever the ism is in that area, you know, whether it's we're going to decide that this entire family should be murdered and discarded in Game of Thrones, or, you know, whether it's a sexism or racism or some kind of like religious bigotry, whatever it is, it's so frightening because it's so plausible. And he is a really scary, convincing villain. And part of that is the performance, but I've also got to credit the writing. It's just so plausible that this man would feel that the only way back to civilization is enslaving and raping women, you know, because it's convenient to control the men that way. And his combination of being almost soulful and dignified and respectable in his way, and just a complete monster, is really compelling. I mean, he's scarier than the zombies by far.
Yeah. And it kind of gets to reinforces a major theme of the film, which is that these are humans that are killing other humans. I mean, that's kind of, when you talk about 28 Days Later as a twist on the zombie movie, one reason you might want to back away from the term is that the film wants to remind you of the human side of these monsters all the time, and remind you that humans themselves can be quite monstrous on their own without having to be zombies. All of that is kind of meaningful. And again, I don't think that a theme like that really comes through if you don't have this piece of the film there.
Yeah, I'm not saying that they shouldn't have encountered the soldiers or that the soldiers shouldn't have behaved the way they did. It's Selena like dropping back as a character and just becoming a classic princess in peril, basically. Mm-hmm. That's what bugs me.
Yeah.
I think Jim going feral is kind of shot and conceived in a really interesting way. I think Boyle gets like a lot of energy out of him running around soaked and wild-eyed and shirtless, clinging to the sides of buildings and jumping in and out of windows. Like, there's a lot of really striking imagery there. And, you know, it feeds back into the theme. Like, he completely gives into his anger. He more or less becomes one of those like raging chimpanzees from the beginning of the movie, like complete to like repeatedly kind of like dropping to all fours and like, you know, moving like a monkey as he kind of traverses this big complicated space. There's a lot of really strong stuff in there. It's not none of the thematic elements, none of the story elements are what bothers me here. It's just, you know, the way his female characters stop being characters and start being like prize objects. So that, if anything, makes the ending where they end up on their own and have to figure out what the future is without all of these men more interesting to me than it would be otherwise. But yeah, I mean, my objections to it are relatively small. You know, if people are saying like bigger things about how the whole third act doesn't work, like I wouldn't buy into that. I think people's inhumanity to other people is a long-term resonant theme that this movie certainly does well.
Mm-hmm. I have a twofold question, because I don't want to just, you know, I think it's easier just to put them in one. Is this a zombie movie? And, you know, this may answer the question itself. How do you feel like it influenced zombie movies? It is kind of credited, whether you consider it a zombie movie or not, with starting the zombie renaissance that enveloped the rest of the decade.
The zombissance.
Yeah, I think it's a zombie movie. Sorry. I know that traditionalists will say zombie movies needed to be a certain way. The zombies here do not behave like zombies.
Can I just ask, what is this movie supposedly miss? Is it the fast zombie thing? Like, what is the problem here?
They're not dead. They're not eating flesh. Mm. You know, they're not following the Romero rules.
Right. But I think there is a malleability to the horror genre that allows for, you know, certain twists on the, I mean, you know, on it. To, I mean, I would call Martin a vampire movie. That's what you want to talk about, Romero.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm fine with this being a zombie movie because I feel like it knowingly is playing in that playground. I mean, like in that sandbox, like, the, you know, specifically, you know, in that sort of utopian scene in the grocery store, you know, which is so reminiscent of them in the mall in Dawn of the Dead, of just like, okay, you were in this horrifying situation and all of this danger, but for this moment, we're in this consumer paradise where we can just throw anything we want in the cart and it's ours. And there's a certain amount of pleasure to that, a certain fantasy that's being lived out. And that's about as direct a connection to Romero and a specific Romero zombie movie as the film gets. So in that sense alone. And then, of course, you know, just this, you know, there's plenty of imagery that I think fits in quite well with the tradition. So I'm on board with it being a zombie movie. And if the result was getting Land of the Dead and The Walking Dead and Shaun of the Dead and all these other zombie films as a result, and that's all the better.
Yeah, I think at heart, any movie that's fundamentally about most of humanity is still around, but they've stopped being people and we can ethically kill them if we want to. Any movie that has that element of, you know, if they bite you, you become one of them, is inherently a zombie movie. Like, I don't care if it's a bioweapon or an infection or a mushroom or an alien attack or whatever. Like, the zombie movie is fundamentally a fantasy of Pyrrhic freedom. You know, it's about, like, what if all of the things that irritate you about society fell away and you could, like, casually kill anybody annoying without a moral problem? I mean, that's the fantasy. And it comes with a zillion different downsides. One of the big ones being, do you become one of them too? But there's a reason that Shaun of the Dead starts with they've all become zombies and nobody notices, because we were all kind of there anyway. You know, these movies are all fantasies about what if I was a survivalist in a world where almost nobody else was a real person anymore. And in that case, it fits the bill. Like, I don't care what they call them in order to get around the Z word. I don't care what the origin of it is. Like, this, yes, of course, this is a zombie movie.
So fast zombies. You know, my first instinct is like, no fast zombies. But you know what? They work here, and they work in a few other movies. I'm going to throw out Train to Busan as a good fast zombie movie.
Scary fast zombie movie.
Yeah. Any others? I mean, there were some others after this.
Nothing that comes immediately to mind.
Zombieland, I think they're fast in Zombieland, if I'm not mistaken.
I seem to remember having a conversation with you at some point in history. Maybe it was 20 years ago, Keith, where you were really not down with the idea of zombies being fast.
That sounds like me. That sounds like me. But you know, other films have proven me wrong.
I was expecting some resistance on this front.
No, I never disliked this movie, though. I always liked this movie.
But in terms of, I think the classification was irksome to you a little bit.
I guess so, but you know. We mellow with age, don't we?
We sure do.
Wait, I'm trying to think of... I mean, there have been so freaking many zombie movies, and Train to Busan maybe stands out more than any of them. I remember finding Army of the Dead, like, fun and stylish I was watching it.
The Zack Snyder one?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think The Girl with All the Gifts is flawed, but, you know, has some solid elements to it.
Mm-hmm. I like Land of the Dead, though. That's a good one.
Yeah, me too. That's got third act problems, but I like that movie.
Good idea, though. It's culturally significant, I think.
Now, here's a question. As I'm just sort of scanning through listings of zombie movies online, they have Wreck listed as a zombie movie.
You know, I've never seen Wreck. I kind of meant to get around to it, but I've never gotten around to that one.
Oh, you really have it? Oh, my God. No. You should see that, man. That is scary as hell. Yeah,
Wreck is very solid.
It's like 90 minutes, man. That'll put hair on your chest.
All right.
Is it a zombie movie per se, though? That's what I'm a little more on the fence about, especially given what it's doing thematically, which does not really fit any of the stuff I just said. Regardless, it's good and it's scary.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
You talk about these being fantasies, Tasha, and I think you're right. But, you know, when I cast myself into different zombie movies, I had to think about how long I would last. I'm just going to say not very long in this one, specifically since it seems like, you know, lightning speed Darwinian weeding out of the week. There's only a few people, you know. We got Selena, we got Frank and Hannah, and then like Jim, I guess, proves himself worthy of still being alive, but mostly he's just been sitting out for the first 28 days. I'm dead pretty quickly in this one, in this world. How about you guys?
28 seconds. Tops. I mean, I have thought about what I would do in the zombie apocalypse as much as the next nerd. I have had nerd discussions with my nerd friends about, you know, what would you do to prove your worth in the zombie apocalypse, or like, where would we go together and where would we go and that kind of thing. I have often joked that I would be the person who gets bit and hides it and, you know, runs rampant at some really inconvenient time, because I'm not a fast runner. And I think one of the things that we learn in this particular movie about this particular zombie apocalypse is that the only way to survive is to just be ready to go ham on somebody with a machete at a moment's notice. And I can't imagine I'd be good at that. I could see zombie apocalypse. What's the plural there? Where I might survive. This is not one of them.
Yeah, I can kind of trick myself into thinking I would do okay in a Romero type scenario, at least not die immediately, because, you know, I have some wits to fall back on, but perhaps not enough to survive very long. Scott, we haven't heard your answer yet, though.
Well, I mean,
he's turned. Get him.
So my feeling is that we're all heroes of our own personal narrative. I'm the central figure in my life here on Earth, and of course I would survive as you can't kill the main character, me. So I'm living. I'm the last one out.
I don't believe you're the last one out for a second, Scott. I think your wife Allie would kick all of the zombies' asses. That's and true. Like haul you bodily to safety.
Right, exactly. She's way more ruthless. She would be the one to be like, seriously, you're not going to machete this guy in the head? Yeah,
let me ask you a question, Scott. How's your back these days?
It's a little bit better. It's a little better. I don't know.
I'm coming over to your place if things go south, Scott, because Allie's going to protect us all. She's going to be the one standing in the doorway with the machete.
I can see that for sure.
Yeah, for sure. Well, when we start talking about how badass our wives are and how much our backs hurt, straight off topic a little too far. We'll be back to 28 Days Later in our next episode, and we'll be back after a short break with some feedback. Now it's time for feedback. But before we get to it, we want to shout out Film Spotting, the Next Picture Show's Mothership podcast, hosted by Adam Campanar and Josh Larson. Upcoming episodes include Adam and Josh's own discussion of Civil War and a summer movie preview. Well, we don't have a summer movie preview planned, but we have seen a lot of trailers lately. Is there anything that's been exciting you about what's coming out this summer?
This never happens. This never happens to us when we go to like a press screening or like a public screening. You know, they usually just show the movie. You just see the movie. If maybe there's one trailer that's an attachment to that,
sure,
to that movie from the studio. We saw a whole like 15 minute suite of summer trailers before Civil War, and you know, groaned our way through almost all of it.
The trailers themselves weren't really that bad. It was just the fact that there was one after another. There's some things I'm looking forward to. I actually think I wasn't a huge fan of Twister, but I think Twisters looks fun, because we got twins in that one. And I was a fan of the last three Planet of the Apes movies, and I'm kind of interested to see. I think this trailer, I wasn't sure we needed another one, but this trailer makes it look interesting.
They're well done. I'll have you review that one for us, though, Keith, because I cannot possibly keep track of all of those.
The
narrative thread I've lost long ago, many films ago.
It's not that hard.
Yeah, exactly. That's why you're doing it. So, I don't know.
I'm excited for Furiosa.
Cautiously
optimistic. Like, that's going to be the summer. It's just, is this going to work or not?
I think the Costner thing has kind of got me going too. I think that he can probably pull that off. That sounds exciting.
You don't underestimate Kevin Costner with a Western, you know?
I'm done doubting what Kevin Costner can do.
Horizon. I've already seen The Bike Riders. It played here in Chicago at the Chicago International Film Festival last year before it got unceremoniously pulled off the schedule and set for this year. And that movie is great. Austin Butler is fantastic in it. It's a taken from a real book about actual Chicago motorcycle gangs, and it captures a moment in history. It feels, for all the world, in some regards, like a 70s movie, except, you know, shot with 2020s cameras. So I'm looking forward to that one coming out. I am, again, cautiously optimistic about Inside Out 2. I was not from the first teaser. I was not from the idea of a sequel to that movie at all, because I think that movie is pretty much perfect. And I don't know that I want that story continued. But some of the things that I saw in the full trailer are intriguing. Some of the themes that the filmmakers have talked about bringing out with it sound intriguing. I'm worried about it, you know, in the way one worries about a Pixar spinoff not made by Pixar coming to Disney Plus. But I'm hoping. I have hopes for it.
Yeah, we'll see.
We will see.
What else? Are we all on board for Bad Boys Ride or Die?
Yeah. I'm not on board for that.
I can't wait. What about the Garfield movie?
Is the Garfield movie going to pick up where A Tale of Two Kitties left off? That's my question.
I think this is a new Garfield continuity that launches a new Garfield verse.
And there is, and this is looking to segue into our next episode, but a new Alien movie with Kaylee Spaney, directed by our old friend Fede Alvarez. So
yeah, I'm excited about that. Alvarez, after his Don't Breathe, I'm kind of on board with anything he does, because that film is so well executed.
I don't know. Alien is the abusive partner that I keep returning to, hoping things are going to be better and he'll stop hitting me.
Good. I've liked all of them. I liked all of them to some degree.
Yeah, I like Covenant. Prometheus, I think I'd like more if I saw it a second time. Yeah,
it's good.
Yeah, you know, the only ones I don't have respect for are the Alien versus Predator movies, although I haven't seen the second one, so maybe that one's great. Who knows?
It's not. It is not. Let them fight. Let them fight.
Oh, hey, well, how about some feedback? We should probably talk about some feedback. So now it's time for it. We always like it when our listeners respond to episodes. We recently got a letter about an episode I was not on and a film I still have not seen. So I'm going to hand this over I'm going to sit this one out. Let Scott read it. Scott?
Sure. Skylar writes, I just wanted to submit a quick comment on this most recent pair of episodes. While I loved all the pairing suggestions during the wrap-up, the filmmaker whose work, Radu Jude, this is Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World, most reminded Skylar of was Kiarostami, in particular The Taste of Cherry, Close Up, and Life and Nothing More, all struck me as having pretty significant overlap with Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. Kiarostami's long meandering driving sequences in A Taste of Cherry and Life and Nothing More, the degree to which the character at the heart of A Taste of Cherry wants to involve the people he meets in something they really don't have a sense of the weight of at first blush, his play with the form and frame of filmmaking, Life and Nothing More, and Close Up, etc., all came off as part of the oddball mix of Jude's film. Of course, they're given a different, much more cynical, tighter the gig economy comic flavor by way of Angela, and Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World. But still, those elements still came off as having some interesting resonances and things to say about the machinery of filmmaking, the experience of being a participatory cog in that machine, and more. Am I off base? I'd love to hear your thoughts. Skylar, no. I'm going to answer your question. No, you're not off base, because I was thinking of Kiarostami as well. How could you not? Because, you know, when you think about a movie in which we're spending most of the time in a car and we're getting our sense of the main character under a certain amount of duress driving through a landscape that I think is, you know, a big part of the commentary of the film, you have to think about a Taste of Cherry specifically. So I was certainly thinking of that. There's so many films though, I feel, and we talked about this when we during the podcast episode, that Radu Jude is a, you know, he draws from a lot of stuff. There's a lot of filmic influences on his work. There's a lot of cultural and political influences on his work. He is really open to a range of influences, and it would not surprise me at all if Kiarostami was one of those influences. What do you think, Tasha?
It's honestly a comparison that wouldn't have occurred to me, just because Do Not Expect Too Much from the End of the World is so profane. And that's just something that, you know, it's such a punk story about such a punk character. And that tonally is something I don't associate with Kiarostami at all. I think that the parallel is there. I just kind of think that Radu Jude's movie is a little bit more like the bratty brother, like the bratty younger brother of Kiarostami. It is thematically similar and similar in some aspects of the execution. It's just so rough and like young and raw in a way. I think of Kiarostami's movies as kind of being about, you know, older people in a dignified place in life, kind of like ruminating about their place in their society, in their culture, in their community, in their family, in their lives. And, you know, here we've got somebody that feels pretty far outside of all of that and is, you know, instead part of this kind of annoying and predatory machine as a replacement for it and resents it. So I think that they pair together really well. And I think this is an astute observation. It's just not one that would have occurred to me.
Yeah.
What about you, Keith?
I haven't seen the movie. I love Kiarostami. This makes me even more intrigued to check it out.
It had not occurred to me that you wouldn't have checked it out.
It's a must-see.
Yeah. I plan on seeing it.
There you go.
Well, we always appreciate when our listeners share their thoughts and their recommendations. If you feel so inclined, we can feature your response on a future episode. To reach us, you can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. And that is it for this episode of The Next Picture Show. In our next episode, we'll talk about Civil War before returning to the world of 28 Days Later and bringing it all together. Look for that episode next Tuesday on your podcatcher of choice. For ad-free versions of the podcast and extra content, find us on Patreon at patreon.com/nextpictureshow. And you can find us at nextpictureshow.net and on Blue Sky at The Next Picture Show if you want to keep track of when new episodes drop. Until next week, stay away from angry chimps. It's just a good rule to live by, whether or not they're infected with rage.